Welcome to the Zoologist's Campfire, the podcast where animal professionals share their best stories. Today, Professor Miquel Arnedo from the Institute for Research on Biodiversity of the University of Barcelona joins us around the crackling fire to share some of his many adventures. Miquel is an evolutionary biologist who studies life's incredible diversity by investigating isolated ecosystems, such as islands and caves. He focuses on spiders to understand the threads that make up the web of life. Miquel's research has taken him around the world, and his findings have been published in hundreds of scientific papers. Miquel, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Harry. How are you?
Thank you for having me today. Yeah, well, I'm glad to have you. It's nice to have a fellow arachnologist. So before we get into your stories, I know you have some. I know that you are particularly interested in spiders, and I can completely imagine that. Of course, I love spiders as well. But what is it that you love so much about spiders?
Well, actually, once I reach that point, I would say everything. But the funny thing is that sometimes people ask me about that, you know, if that was kind of like a long life love for spiders, you know. I guess some of my colleagues, maybe yourself, I mean, you started as a kid, you know, kind of going to the field and, you know, getting like all, you know, obsessed with spiders, with bugs in general. I have to say, I was not like that. I mean, when I was a kid, I loved nature, but, you know, I was not a, you know, somebody who will go and collect and have all the, you know, his room full of all these bugs all over. I actually got interested into spiders once I started my PhD. When I was looking for a topic, at that time I was really interested on phylogeny and evolutionary biology. So I was really ready to, you know, to work with any organism that offered me the opportunity to work on phylogenetics. And it happened at the time that there was this professor, Carlos Rivera, with the spider specialist as well. Like, he had this project, you know, to study this group of spiders in the Canary Islands from an evolutionary standpoint. So I just joined him in that research. And once you started with spiders, I have to say, there is no way out, like, basically. And then you absolutely fall in love with them. They're amazing creatures. And so basically, like, the last 30, 35 years of my life, I've been fully devoted to spiders.
Yes,
so no way back.
And traveling everywhere, climbing mountains and going down into caves.
Right. Lucky. I've been so lucky, you know, to have the opportunity to do a lot of field work and in very different places. So as you were mentioning in the introduction, I didn't particularly focus on isolated systems, mostly islands, but also mountain tops. Mm-hmm. But I also had the opportunity to join other colleagues in other trips in different places. I mean, basically, every time I have the opportunity to join somebody to go to the field, and I have the less and less time for doing so, I always try to, you know, to join in.
Yeah. Once you get big and important, you get to do less and less actual research.
yeah, that's a sad story. But we shouldn't say that, because otherwise all the young generations will have to follow it.
Well, they can change it, probably. And you're taking a lot of students with you in the field as well, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, most of the field work actually is always associated to funded projects. And most of the times, this project also involves PhD students or master's students or even undergrad students. And I guess part of the training we offer is basically taking them to the field as well, you know, and getting them to learn, you know, basically how to, you know, I mean, all the procedures, all the methods, you know, which are basically focused on field work.
Right. And so you've had some adventures, and you've thought about some of your best ones today. I'm really curious. So let's start with your first story. Where did it happen? What were you going to do?
Yeah.
What was the plan?
I tried to take samples from, you know, different moments in time and in different places, mm-hmm. as well. One story, well, I mean, I don't know how fun is that, but I mean, at that moment, that was terrifying and also and laughable. That was actually, we're doing a field work. That was actually one of the first international congresses I joined. And that was we're talking about 2001, so, right? Uh-huh. Like more than 20 years ago. And that was the International Congress of Arachnology in South Africa, in Bad Plas. And because it was such, so, you know, such a long trip. At that time, I was postdoc in Hawaii, so it was basically crossing the half the world to go there. So I thought that, you know, it would be also, you know, after doing all this to spend some time then collecting. So I joined a group of alpha technologies that were planning to do some field work there. And because that was my first time in sub-Saharan Africa, I thought, you know, it would be a good opportunity to get to learn a little bit the spider fauna there. So I joined them, and we actually, it was an amazing trip. We spent like a couple of weeks, almost 3 weeks, collecting all over.
South Africa is so amazing country, right?
Oh no, that was crazy. That was absolutely crazy. In terms of, you know, such a different ecosystems, and, well, you know, I mean, being born and raised in Europe, really, I mean, it's difficult for you to imagine that you can be surrounded by things that can at any time can eat you or like just basically like crush you, you know. So it's kind of an experience. And at that particular time, we were actually visiting this nature reserve. It was called St. Lucia. There was a wetland not far from Durban. And and that was, you know, that was my first encounter with this this usually like kind of like kind of, at least in the cartoons for kids, you know, these are always happy animals that are hippopotamus. You know, remember we were actually taking this guide. We were actually collecting in this wetland forest. And the guy just, you know, kind of like stressed us that, you know, hippos are not like, you know, can be very, very dangerous, especially when they are on land, you know, because they are very short-sighted. And, you know, when they hear some noise, they basically kind of like run into you. But they also can be pretty nasty when they are in the water, especially, you know, if you're kind of like, you know, bothering them with a boat or something. So but anyway, so he basically was giving us some hints, you know, about what to do, what not to do, some tips. And basically we had to take this boat, this very basic boat. Basically it was a very narrow boat, kind of like old fashioned canoe. So I think we were five people, one after the other in a line, you know, and we were basically crossing this river to go to this island that was like in the middle of the river to collect there.
Of course. Yeah.
So basically we're like, you know, going with a boat with this guy, and he actually points, you know, a herd of hippos, you know, nearby. And all of a sudden, the hippos, I mean, after actually we got these tips, you know, be careful with hippos, these hippos start like to disappear, you know, they start to like sink, you know, to go underwater and disappearing from our view.
Yeah.
And I was like, David, I was really uneasy. And all of a sudden, this boat got stuck into a sandbank, okay? So we basically had to jump outside the water, into the water, and try, you know, to reduce the load of the boat and try to move the load. And like walk, you know, carrying the boat through, I would say, maybe 50 meters. And, you know, that experience of doing that with the hippos disappearing like just 100 meters from you, that was quite what experience. Nothing happened, I have to say. But, you know, that I had the time of my life. So when we arrived to the island, I was the happiest person ever. So that was kind of, at that time it was terrifying, but then, you know, we were thinking about that. It was kind of fun. But that was,
yeah, I mean,
that
if they would have stayed at the surface, you know where they
yeah,
are.
Yeah, exactly. Right? At least you can spot them. You're right. Yeah. But that, no, that was, they disappeared just at the time where actually you have to sink, you have to jump outside the boat. So that was not a very kind of reassuring situation. But anyway, we survived that. It was just you know, I mean, I kind of like to think about that time because that was my first introduction, you know, with like real wild big animals, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, in Europe, basically the only thing that can kill you is probably another human. In you know, in these places, there are real big animals out there, you know. And it's a kind of, again, it's a funny feeling for somebody who is not used to that, you know.
Yeah. And hippos kill more people than lions, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's they rank the first, I think, in accidents with a wild fauna in Africa. I remember other places that we go in this same trip, you know, there was this, it was a hunting reserve. And actually in that place, we had to go with guys with rifles because, you know, a week before a lion had eaten one of the visitors. So, I mean, I know for me, I remember that time and I was quite young as well. And again, my first experience, like in a real kind of like, you know, place where you have like still like big animals kind of like roaming around freely, and that was, you know, I have, you know, some of these situations, you know, stick in my brain.
So you were happy to get to the island.
Experience. Oh no, yeah, I was so happy, you know. Yeah, I'm
But then
in
you had to
general
go
happy to
back.
arrive to Ireland. I eventually have to go back, yeah. But at that time, you know, the guide or the driver of the boat was careful enough not to get stuck in any sandbank.
Oh,
So
good.
that was okay. It was not a long distance. It just like happened to be, you know, very inconvenient sandbank we got stuck in. So, but anyway, that was kind of I
Awesome.
always remember that time, kind of like both
So,
terrifying and fun.
yeah, South Africa is just a gorgeous country.
It
It's
is.
I am looking
It
forward
is.
to go back
No.
one day. Yeah, it's
Yeah. No,
amazing.
me too. Me too. I have to say, I mean, I haven't. I mean, that's the only time I've been in South Africa. I never return again. And I will. I will love to go back there. It was a great trip, really. Yeah.
But you
So
got
that
some
was.
spiders on the island, I imagine.
We did. And that at that time, I mean, that was a kind of like general collecting. So, I mean, which is actually not so common for me because I mean, most of the times I do field work to collect specific groups. You know, we are working with most of our research is actually focused in particular groups. We're trying to understand the evolution of these families of spiders. So most of the times we were going after something very particular. This particular trip was just like general collecting. You know, we're a mixed group of arachnologists with different interests. For myself, because I was actually at that time was funded by the University of Hawaii. And I was also working in the Bishop Museum. It was just an opportunity to improve their collections of spiders from different places in the world. So I was basically collecting any kind of spiders, so which is kind of fun as well because you get the opportunity to see a lot of different things. You know, most of the time I'm just like so focused in one particular group that I cannot see anything else. You know, I've been collecting spiders, for example, I've done a lot of field work in the Canary Islands, and I've been like collecting. I mostly work in this family called Viscerity. The red devil spiders, that they are ground dwellers. They're nocturnal, you see. So basically, we collect them when they are kind of hiding from light, and they're usually under stones or under blocks. So most of the times, I'm just like turning stones up, you know, looking for spiders under stones. I've been in the Canary Islands with, you know, turning up stones with like big lizards, you know, the genus Galotia, like that. And I couldn't see the lizard. I was just looking for the spider. And somebody else had to come and say, "Oh, there's a big lizard there. Oh shit, I didn't see it." So.
Don't bother me with the lizard. I'm looking for
Yeah,
a little
exactly.
red
No, yeah.
spider.
Remove it. Yeah, remove this lizard from here. But yeah. Most of the times, I'm a little bit like that. I really narrow my focus a lot, and I'm looking for very. And it's amazing how the human brain can only spot particular things when you are only interested in these things. Yeah.
No, if you're looking for a spider, you just walk past a
Yeah.
snake or a lizard without even seeing it. It's
Right.
a
Well, you know
search image.
this funny experiment where actually they show this video to people where actually people is dancing.
Oh, yeah.
And all of a sudden, a gorilla shows up, and people cannot see it because, I mean, they're not paying attention to a gorilla, they're paying attention to people.
Yeah,
So
no.
exactly like
I've
that.
done that. I did not see the gorilla.
No, absolutely. So, yeah, so if you're only looking for one thing, you're only going to be able to spot that.
And if you're bringing people in the field and they say, oh, he always finds the lizards and the snakes and the spiders, like, well, I can only look for one thing at a time, actually.
No, absolutely. Sometimes people say, "Oh, you were actually collecting this page. Did you see this particular?" I didn't see anything else than my spider. Sorry.
Oh yeah, it's even worse with scorpions because you bring a scorpion light and they light up at
Oh
night,
yeah.
which is something great to have with
So
scorpions. You don't have any
yeah.
spiders, but you don't see any snakes. That's the problem.
Yeah. That's I have to say I have a problem with snakes. Funny enough, I mean I can handle anything except snakes. I don't know.
Really?
Yeah, have a very hard time with snakes.
Okay.
Yeah, so yeah, I never got over that. I mean, I love it. I think they're amazing animals. But it's just I don't like to find them when I especially and again because I'm like you know spending a lot of time turning stones up. It's not uncommon to find like snakes there, you know.
Nope,
And in some places, you really don't want to find them
no.
unless you're actually after them.
Awesome. Well, you're making it sound pretty glamorous already. Hawaii, South Africa, Canary Islands. That's
Okay.
not
What
bad.
can I offer you now? Okay, that was it, but other story. And that was actually a little bit more a less not so good memory, I have to say. So this time we were in Turkey. That was in 2006, I reckon. And again we were joining this party of people. We were actually doing mostly caves. But at that time, I was telling you before, I was pretty interested in this family of spiders, the red devils. This is the most Mediterranean family, so I've been trying to collect them all over. So I joined these people because actually they had the permit to collect in Turkey, especially around the Black Sea coast in the northern part of Anatolia. So I, you know, it was at that time, it was not such an easy place to go, and it was difficult to get a permit. So I, you know, I was happy, you know, to be able to join these people. So we organized this trip, and we were basically, you know, driving from Istanbul towards Ankara, and we just crossed, you know, the strait, and they were right on Anatolia, and then we said to go to this place where actually some of the people was supposed to do caving. So I was actually collecting outside. And again, I was doing my work thing, going around, you know, turning up stones, big stones. And this particular one, that was we were about to leave. So basically, somebody said that, you know, he had enough. So he said, okay, guys, let's go to the next place. And of course, you know, I had to turn up the very last stone. That was a huge stone. So I went there. I started, you know, to try to turn this thing up. And all of a sudden, I mean, it was so heavy that it basically fell on me.
Oh.
Luckily, I was right at the border of kind of like an embankment, like in a steep, you know, kind of like downhill. And me and the stone, we both go down, you know, rolling. And that was amazing. I was feeling like, you know, these like these cartoons of the Wild Coyote and the Road Runner, you know, but that was basically like that. I was feeling like the Wild Coyote. I mean, I was going down with a stone. I mean, literally, I couldn't get. Remove the stone from me. We were like one single unit going down the hill. Yeah. Ouch. It felt like I was falling for like hundreds and hundreds of meters. Probably it was just like 3 or 4 meters. But at that time, the time really goes very, very slowly. And unfortunately, at the very end, when we arrived at the base of the hill, I mean, the stone just fell into my hand, my left hand.
Uh-huh.
And kind of squash it. Yeah. And two of my fingers, the little finger and the next one, they literally open, like, you know, like a banana, like a peeling a banana. So basically you could see the bone through. So it was not a very nice view. So luckily one of the guys in this group of people, he was trained like in first aid and he basically, you know, and he was amazing actually. He kind of like calmed me down because I was getting a little bit anxious because of the situation. So he basically wrapped up the fingers. And just imagine, the guy was cold enough to actually find my nail because one of the nails fell down. He collected the nail as well.
Ouch.
So wrapped the whole thing in.
Man.
And yeah, and we were like in the middle of nowhere. I mean, the thing was like bleeding like hell. And we were in the middle of nowhere, and we were about like 3 hours drive from Ankara. So basically the guy said, okay, I mean, we go straight to Ankara because, you know, that really looks nasty, and you better find like a good hospital, you know, to take care of that. So basically we start driving. At that time I was like basically hallucinating because I lost a lot of blood, of course. But then the guy said, just by the way while we were driving, they called to the Spanish embassy in Ankara. We were all a party of Spanish people. And the Spanish embassy looked for a clinic, a hospital who was specialized on hands. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, there was this hospital which actually specialized in taking care of hand accidents. So we went straight there. Turned out the doctor there just came back from Barcelona. So the guy was fell in love with the city. So he really gave me a very good, he treated me very well. And yeah, we just arrived there, and we went straight to the surgery room.
Yes.
And then I got like the full, I got sleep completely. You know, that was the only time in my life actually I got the full anesthesia, and then they kind of fixed the two fingers. They put the nail back. Actually, the guy was especially interested in the nails. It turned out to be a good thing because he told me that, you know, if without the nail, I mean, it's difficult to regrow the nail. So you have to have the nail fixed to actually the cell at the bottom of it, they can regrow finally. So yeah, he actually, you know, it's the two fingers. They kind of like, you know, kind of put them back the right place.
Wow.
I was there for a couple of days. Yeah. And yeah. So, and after that, I still spent two weeks collecting there with one hand only. So I need somebody who helped me to turn up stones. Oh yeah. Yeah. I was,
you went right back into the field after that.
Oh yes. Yeah. After 2 days, we went back to the field. Yeah. And that was great actually, because I need to get like some, first aid, basically I had to go like every 2 days to some hospital to, to clean up and, you know, kind of like revise the stitches. And that was great, actually, I have to say. I mean, at that time, I really came to admire the health system in Turkey, because, I mean, you know, any place we want, everything was kind of like, you know, subsidized by the state. It was free. It was also free for foreigners. So I really got the best treatment. But yeah, that was one of the, I mean, I have to say, I'm going to touch wood here, but that was the only serious accident, let's say, I've had in the field. And I was lucky enough to keep, like, doing the collecting afterwards.
I mean, so. Falling with a big rock, I mean, it could have landed anywhere, right? Your hand is
no, absolutely.
But your head is a little bit.
Absolutely. And on the top of that, I was lucky because at that time I was actually wearing several rings, like big rings. And actually, two of them, no, actually, the one in the second finger, I mean, it was completely squashed. It actually probably saved the finger, I had to say. I still keep the ring. I should make something like a necklace or something of that. It's completely squashed, but it was, that was a saver. So, yeah, that was one of the down stories, I guess.
No, it's good to know that things like this happen.
Yeah.
The fact that you just went straight back to the field after that, most people would go home, Mikael, I think.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I at that time, and I'm still like that. I mean, so I'm so... get into that, I mean, to the field, but it's both in terms of the nature that, of course, I love, but also of the places. You know, one thing that really motivates me to go to the field, it's also the cultural part of it. You know, so and especially because I've been doing a lot of sampling in the Mediterranean, I really love this mix of, you know, nature, but also culture, kind of ancient remains, gastronomy,
there's a
food.
Lot of
you know,
old culture around the Mediterranean, right?
Absolutely, and that really motivates me a lot. And at that time, you know, Turkey is always a place that I have been obsessed with. I mean, I really love it. And that was, you know, the opportunity to go to the Black Sea Coast, which is not so visited. Went to Trebizond. You know, some of the places where, as a kid, when I was reading books of, you know, travel books, you know, always wanted to go. So yeah, that kind of like actually pushed me to keep doing the field work even, you know, after the accident.
Oh, wow. Well, you may be pushing me to go to Turkey too, because I've never been, and it sounds...
Oh, you should definitely go there. I mean, I will say, yeah, if I get lost, just go and look for me in Turkey.
Right, still love it even after
part of
Turkey crushed your hand.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
but
you know,
they're
not responsible. It was my... Actually, I have to say, the only thing that's kind of funny is that my little finger is kind of like pointy at the end now. It's not missing, but other than that, it's okay, yeah.
Yeah, even has a nail on it.
Right, it's still happening. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, yeah, that's a good one. I mean,
that was
I haven't heard many that serious incidents with rocks. I mean, people always drop a rock on their foot or something, or scratch a leg or something. Hmm. Wow.
Yeah, no, I guess it's one of the downsides of working with spiders that, you know, have the habit of hiding under rocks, basically.
Yeah, well, scorpions too. Yeah.
I have you're right. Yeah. But you guys take advantage of the fact that they're at night, you know, you can see them and spot them at night, and then for the time they are moving around. So that's good.
Yeah, it's also the more pleasant time to be around in those hot countries.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Do you also have the effect, in the beginning we were doing field work without gloves, and after a couple of days of turning sharp rocks, you have no more fingerprints, right?
No, absolutely. Well, but that's absolutely like that. I mean, I've been trying then to use my finger to open my phone, you know, remember the time that actually you were using that, and you cannot. I mean, it's just basically you lose all the fingerprints. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. Now we use gloves all the time. That's much,
yeah,
much better.
No, makes sense. Yeah. I mean, I think that when you're younger, I mean, you feel like, you know, nothing can destroy you, so you really don't care about anything, you know. You get older and you have more experience, say, okay, no, I'm not going to go through that, you know. I have to keep what is left of myself. I have to take good care of.
Awesome. And so it's mostly around the Mediterranean. Have you ever gone to any tropical countries for the spiders, or is that not?
We did quite a bit of work. We had this project in Panama, actually. That was in 2008 and 2009. We did a couple of expeditions to the cloud forest in Panama.
Wow.
And that was, that was quite an amazing experience. That's probably been together with South Africa, the northern parts of South Africa that was getting a little more tropical. That was, you know, one of the only tropical places where I've been doing, like, let's say, professional collection of spiders. And that was amazing. You know, the cloud forest in Panama is really crazy. Panama, I have to say, has some of the best preserved tropical forest in Latin America, Central America, for sure.
Yeah, and
especially because of the Panama Canal. So basically, all the water, we have to preserve all the watershed around the canal, because actually the water they get, you know, to fill it up, it comes from the watershed. So they have to preserve all the forest around. But other than that, even like going all the mountain range, the dorsal range going up to Costa Rica, it's you know, the mountain wild forest is very well preserved. So it's, that was amazing place to collect. Yeah, we did, in this case, we did some standardized collecting, because this year we want to compare the spider communities in four different spots. So we actually have this kind of you know, transect in four spots along the Cordillera, going from La Campana, which is more or less close to the canal, all the way close to the border with Costa Rica and the National Park La Amistad, which is a shared park between the two countries. And then we had like these four spots. We basically had these four spots that had plots of 100 by 100 by 1 hectare plot. And we did continuous collecting for, I don't know, all together. It was like, we were like six people collecting for 5 hours a day for 3 days. So we did a lot of collecting. Yeah. So the idea was basically having like a complete inventory of the spiders community there.
Yeah,
and that was a place that we had some like bad encounters with like serious, you know, snakes there. Yeah. So that was quite scary.
That's your favorite.
But but other than that, that was a great experience. One of the places actually I love, I really like, and I've been lucky enough to visit several times, and that's going back to the island, is the Juan Fernandez Archipelago.
Where is that?
This is off the coast of Chile. It's right in front of Valparaíso, not far from Santiago. Yeah, it's about like 300, 250 kilometers into the sea from Valparaíso. And these are mainly two islands, Robinson Crusoe and Alejandro Selkirk, which in the I mean, they're actually quite far apart. I mean, they're the closest to the continent, which is Robinson Crusoe, is about 250 kilometers, and then the two of them are separated by another 200 kilometers. So it's not really too close, really, a close archipelago. It's more like two islands, more or less isolated.
And these are volcanic oceanic islands.
Yeah, these are volcanic islands as well. I think Robinson Crusoe is about 3.5 million and Selkirk is 1 million. Since 2000, I think we started there in 2013. That's a project I've been doing with in collaboration with my good friend Gustavo Ormiga. Which an often acknowledges. He was born in Spain, but he has done most of his career actually in the States. He's professor at the George Washington University. And we've done a lot of field work together, and we've shared some projects. And we started this project in Juan Fernandez in 2012, I think. And it's basically about the evolution of this group of spiders. They are linifeeds, they are dwarf spiders.
Yeah.
They are all over. I guess it's the most diverse spider family in terms of number of species and probably also genera. They're all over, but this particular group, the Erigonines, they managed to colonize these archipelagos, and they undergone an amazing radiation. So we basically wanted to study this group. So starting in 2012, we have been visiting the islands, I think, four times already.
Okay, nice.
And also Chile to look for outgroups. So actually, we just went to Chile, to the southern part of Chile this last, when was that? In February, March.
Okay.
That was great. Sweet. That's amazing. That's another amazing place, Chile. But these islands in particular are, you know, are quite an experience. I would say it's both a natural and sociological experience, you know, because, I mean, they are remote. It's only one village. The only people that live there is in one single village in this Robinson Crusoe. And in the other island, there is no permanent village. There's only a temporal village, I think during 8 months a year. The inhabitants of Robinson Crusoe are allowed to go to Selkirk, basically to fish a lobster. That's, I mean, the
I
whole
see.
Economy of the island is based on lobster fishing, and they actually deliver that to restaurants all over, actually alive. They mostly send them to Japan.
Okay.
Yeah, so the whole economy of the place is based on these lobsters. So basically, 85% of the people, I guess, is fishing lobsters, and the rest of the people are just providing some services for them. So
yeah,
it's quite a place. It's quite quite a place. It's difficult to arrive there, but still there's a regular flight to Robinson Crusoe, but it's super expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, and you when you're there, you really felt quite isolated, because after there's not a whole lot of tourism because it's very expensive and there are not so many things to do. But the place is really incredible.
Yeah, I mean,
a small tiny island. Yeah.
Must be one
and then
of the
going
most
to Selkirk.
Yeah, it's on Earth.
It's not remote in terms of how far it is, because Hawaii is much far away from everything else. But it's, you really feel you are in the middle of nowhere, because it's more difficult to arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, there's flights going to Robinson, but to go to Selkirk, you basically have to rely either on some fishing boat that goes there.
Yeah.
Or there is a one a merchant boat, a big ship that goes like once a month to provide supplies for these people.
Okay.
So it's quite a challenge. And actually, we've been there 4 or 5 times, but we only managed to go to Selkirk twice. And that was basically like, you know, convincing some fisherman to take us there. But going with a fishing boat, it takes you about 8 to 9 hours to go to the island. It's an overnight. And, you know, yeah, we have a lot of stories. Basically, you know, going through, you know, from one island to the other, these 8 hours, like basically, you know, as my colleague was always saying, feeding the fishes, because basically you start like vomiting after 5 minutes, maybe, you know, that you are there, moving up and down, and then you try to sleep, and it's really impossible, and you have to go to the, down to the, to, well, this one room is used for, you know, to sleep, but also to store stuff, to put lobsters, even. So it's not the perfect spot to have a proper nap, but anyway, it's quite an experience.
Sure, sleeping the first with time the lobsters,
actually,
yeah.
Yeah, sleeping with a lobster. Well, actually, when we're going towards there, they are empty, because basically what they do is they go to the Selkirk Island to load the lobsters and then go back to deliver them by plane. But that was this time, the first time I actually went to Selkirk. Yeah, that's an amazing place, because the island is as big as the other one, but basically there's only this temporal village, which probably about 200 people or more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole island is empty. So basically, it's only like people from the village that spend, you know, what they like to do when they are not fishing, when they have some free time, where they go up to the mountains to hunt goats.
Okay.
So interestingly, these goats, which are also a pest, because basically they are eating everything there.
Yeah.
They were introduced. So basically, the islands were discovered by this Portuguese sailor. I think he actually was working by the Spanish Armada. So they discovered these islands, and basically the Spaniards, the colonizadores, they were using this island kind of a stepping stone to go, you know, from Chile towards Peru. And basically what they did, and that's something they used to do commonly with these islands, that, you know, they were not very interested in colonizing, is they free porks, they free goats to have food, you know, fresh food when they come
back. Yeah.
So that was the origin of these goats. And by the way, that's very interesting. It turns out these goats belong to a race, to a breed that they already disappeared in Spain. So way, they also have some kind of conservation interest and cultural interest.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's been a lot of NGOs, conservation NGOs, have been trying to get rid of the goats, because, I mean, they're basically eating all the endemic vegetation.
Yeah.
But then you get in conflict with the local people, because for the local people, culturally speaking, the goats are important, because it's the, you know, hunting goats is like a big thing.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
It's exactly the same situation in Hawaii. When I was in Hawaii, it's the same happened with the wild pigs. You know, they had these pigs, the pigs went feral. They basically introducing all kind of introduced plants into the forest, because they eat the plants, and they kind of like poop in the forest, and then you have all the seeds. So. And they're trying to control the population, and then the locals, they don't want to even hear about getting rid of the pork, because, you know, I mean, part of the culture has to do with hunting the pork.
Yeah.
In the case of Juan Fernandez, they call. But anyway, we went to this to Selkirk. So we're going with people from the CONAF, which is the governmental agency that takes care of conservation.
Mm-hmm.
So the rangers actually were helping us there and providing guidance because they are not really kind of trails, basically. So, you know, you walk around places that people know more or less where to go through.
Yeah.
I went to get, you know, to go up to the mountain to do some collecting up there. So we went with this guy, and we were basically, you know, walking up, because basically that's just about mountain. It's a big volcano, so you have to, you know, keep walking up and going up.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, you know, we decided to stop in this place and to put together to mount the tents to spend the night there, because we were doing night collecting. And the time say, okay, well, I'm going to leave you here, guys. You do your stuff, and I'm going to go and take a walk. Well, the guy was carrying a rifle, of course, so the guy went to hunt for goats.
Okay.
So, you know, he, you know, off he goes. We were standing there, you know, again, mounting the tent and doing some collecting. And after a couple, I mean, we hear, you know, we actually heard, you know, a couple of like shots. And after an hour or so, the guy shows up with two goats, kind of like tied up, dead, starting on his shoulders, you know, oof, coming to us. And the guy is just like, do you guys have some knife or something? And my colleague, Gustavo, he had like a Swiss Army knife. You know, I said, yeah, I have that. Oh, yeah, sure, no problem. He takes the guy, gets one of the goats. He hangs the goat from a tree. And he skins the goat with a freaking jacket, Swiss Army jacket. We were like in shock. We were like, no kidding me. I mean, you leave me here with a goat, I wouldn't know what to do with that. So the guy just like, you know, kind of skinned the goat, remove all everything, remove all the cleaning. Apparently, there's a symbiosis there because by the time he was doing that, there were a couple of endemic hawks of this island. You know, mm-hmm. they were already sitting there, you know, waiting because they know that, you know, the hunters are going to remove the internal organs. You know, they're going to throw them away. So they're actually feeding on that.
Ah.
Yeah, the guy got the goat ready, prepared. The next day, when we walked down, he actually was carrying the skin goat.
Yeah.
The next day, we actually took the fishing boat back. The guy was with us. And in the middle of nowhere, I mean, the middle of the sea, he actually prepared a barbecue and he barbecued the goat. So that was our lunch for the next day. Yeah. So that was quite an experience. Anyway.
I imagine it was a very good goat.
Oh no, that was an amazing, you know. You have to feel sorry about that poor goat, but you know, I was saying to you before, that's part of this, I'm going to call it cultural, but sociological experience, you know, you go through that. I mean, because as a urbanized, because, you know, I was born and grew up in a big city. And when you have these opportunities, if, you know, you imagine yourself, you get marooned in an island and, you know, the only thing you have is like a machete, let's say, and you have to provide food for yourself. We will be so helpless. I will be so helpless. And this guy was skinning a freaking goat with a Swiss Army knife. You know?
Yeah, which is a tiny little knife like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing.
Providing, you know. So you really, you know, you have to survive. You really feel like, you know, you don't belong there. I mean, you last 2 hours in any of these places.
And that is very cool to see, right? That people can still live like that.
Oh yeah. I mean, these people have, you know, I mean, all the commodities where they are. But I mean, they know their, you know, the surrounding. They know the nature. They know how to provide, you know, food and stuff. Again, that was quite amazing. Yeah. There was another very nice story, and then just to change a little bit of the perspective, but that also has to do with this kind of connection, you know, with the past.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, some of the collecting we're doing in these islands, we're basically following the track, following the places that were visited in the 50s by this guy. He was called Boris Malkin.
Okay.
He was a guy born in Hungary. And during the 50s, 60s, he was hired by the American Museum as a professional collector. So basically, the guy will go to places funded by the American Museum to collect, you know, everything. He was mostly focused on bugs and insects mostly, but he did a lot of spider collection. So some of the actually pieces that we were after were collected by him in the 50s, and they were, I mean, they were stored at the American Museum, and then somebody else in the 70s, in the 90s, early 90s, actually studied them and described the species, and that was how we started, you know, to get into that.
All right.
But this guy was like a hero for us, you know, because all the time we were like, oh, no, we have to go to this locality that Boris visited. And you think, I mean, I'm the 50s, going to this particular place, it takes you like, even if it's small, tiny islands, it will take you like a day to go there because you have to go up and down volcanoes, you know, cross for like very deep forests, very steep places. And this guy is our freaking hero. so I know we were in this Selkirk again in this island, and we were like talking with some of the fishermen, and one of the guys all the time say, oh no, I heard about that, my mom was mentioning about this Boris guy.
Oh.
And actually this guy Fernando and somebody else, they actually went with Boris to the field. What?
Cool.
Yeah, so we went to look for these guys, and these guys actually, they were in his 80s or something like that, since 15. And yeah, when they were like 10 years old, something like that, they actually went with Boris to some of these places with Ron Malkin.
So it was, wow.
It was kind of it was kind of like some mystical, experience for us, you know, like getting in touch with somebody that we were, you know, that actually helped our hero, Boris Malkin.
Wow. Yeah,
so, yeah, that was another remarkable thing. Right,
yeah.
absolutely. But this part of the thing, you know, I mean, when you do this kind of you're visiting these places, when you're especially when you're off the track, you know, because then, yeah, you can do a lot of traveling, you can visit places as a tourist, and that's great, and it's really exciting. The good thing of doing field work is you get to go to places and contact people that is complete off the beaten track, you know, and this is you all the time have these kind of experiences with actually kind of like, you know, return everything you have
I
invested
mean,
in terms of resources.
that is a very remote place, and that's an amazing connection, of
Yeah,
course, to talk
yeah.
to those people. But in my experience, even when you are in very touristic places, if you're after animals, you go to places that tourists don't go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But believe it or not, I mean, I've been working a lot in the Canary Islands, I will tell you before. I've been probably, I don't know, 20 times in Canary Islands. I have never, ever in my life go to the beach. I mean, I've been twice, but just for collecting spiders. I've never actually swim in the Canary Islands, which, you know, when I talk with some of my friends, just like, what's wrong with you? But yeah, this is how
No, I
focused we
mean,
are.
oh no, you don't go to the, I have been to the beach in the Canary Islands. Don't go.
No,
Don't
that's
go.
not the best, the most remarkable place for beaches, I have to say.
No, but it's amazing. Just the barrenness of them
Yeah.
is quite amazing. And I can only imagine that those islands around Chile are even more, and especially if you come from Robinson Crusoe Island,
Yeah.
the isolation is already in the name, right?
The funny thing is that this is not the original names of the islands. So the islands were originally named Más Adentro and Más Afuera, which means the closest and the farther away from the continent. But then I think it was in the 70s or in the 80s, the tourist office of the Chilean government decided that was not catchy enough for tourism, so they replaced their names by Robinson Crusoe, which, because actually, I mean, I forgot to mention that, but these actually are the islands where Robinson Crusoe, the novel of William Dafoe, is based on. So the history is based on this Scottish sailor, which is Alejandro Selkirk, the name that was named after the other island. And he was marooned in these islands in the, I think it was in the 18th century. And the other interesting thing is that Selkirk was not, I mean, he was not marooned there because he thinks his boat's not there. No. They couldn't stand him, so they kicked him out from the boat. That's, you know, how bad is that? So of course Dafoe had to make some changes to make the character a little bit more appealing.
I mean, what do you have to do to be kicked off
To
a
be
boat?
exactly, to be kicked off a ship, you know. So yeah. So apparently he was not the most popular guy there.
Amazing. Amazing. It sounds like you have been to some amazing amazing places. Are there any places that you still have on your list?
Always. I mean, that's the reason to keep doing what I do. Well, next thing is not so exotic. We have a project now where we're going to be doing a lot of similar to what I was explaining to you about the Panama. We're doing this standardized sampling in plots for doing comparisons of spider communities across, you know, big gradients. In this particular case, we will be focusing on spider communities in Cork Oak Forest, which, as you know, is a forest typical from the Western Mediterranean. So basically, we're gonna be, I think, mid-May to mid-June, we're gonna be in the field. We're gonna be visiting these plots, which are distributed all over the Iberian Peninsula, and Spain mostly. But we'll be, you know, basically, there are 24 plots. So we're gonna do it 2 years. We're gonna visit 12 plots this year, 12 plots next year. And this is basically driving all around the peninsula. The Iberian Peninsula is about 405,000 kilometers of driving altogether. So it's the whole tour. And basically every day we'll be collecting one of these plots. And the idea here again is we'll be trying to find out, you know, how environmental changes, most of them actually related to human activity, both in terms of climatic change, but also in terms of of taking profit of this cork oak forest, mostly because of the cork, but also because, I mean, they use sometimes to feed, you know, as you know, the special brand of breed of Iberian pig for jamón. So basically there are forests that has been like traditionally quite exploited, and then you have all these different gradients of very open forest or very closed forest that has not been, you know, used in the last decades, but also forests that are continuous, like mostly in the southwest Spain and Portugal, yeah. Or like small pockets, like for example in northern Spain. There are places actually where I was not even aware that there were cork oak forests, like in the Basque Country, for example. Huh. So in the Basque Country, we have like 5 hectares of cork oak forest.
Should be very different. It's very much wetter.
Absolutely, yeah. So it offers us great opportunity to see, you know, how these different, you know, climatic gradients, but also the use by humans, may affect, in this case, spider communities. So yeah, that's what comes next.
That sounds like an amazing road trip.
Yeah, it's not exotic, but it's going to be amazing for food, for example.
Yeah.
So yeah, and also there are some beautiful places, I have to say, in the Iberian Peninsula.
Of course, yeah.
As you're well aware of. So yeah, that's nice. What's coming next. So yeah.
So, and people want to keep an eye on you and find out what you're doing. Where do they go? Where we can find?
Yeah, them? we keep this Twitter and Instagram accounts where we, you know, when we go to the field, we try to upload some pictures.
Oh, great!
So I can provide you with a link, maybe.
Yes, I'll put it in the description of this podcast. So if you're listening, yeah, and you want to see what Mika is up to,
I will send you right. This is the spider cyst from Systematics Evo from Evolution. So this is you can find us there in both Twitter and Instagram. I mean, sometimes we're not so active, but you know, especially when we go to the field, we always try to upload some pictures and make some comments, so they can track us there.
At Spider Cyst Evo. All right.
Right.
And Cyst is with a Y. All right. Yeah. Mikael, thank you very much for your amazing stories.
Well,
I knew you
that was
a
real that was a real pleasure, Ari. And congratulations on this initiative. It's really amazing. I mean, I think you're doing a terrific job. So
thank you. I'm glad you
that was
doing
a real
it.
Pleasure.
And,
absolutely.
Catch you very soon. Because we're both on a defense committee.
Right.
And
we'll
speak in real life. But for now, thank you very much, and till next time.
Thank you, Ari.